This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Good evening. My name's Lisa Loving. I'm the KBOO Evening News Director. A member of the KBOO staff has been diagnosed with the dreaded and highly contagious norovirus. Tonight and for the rest of the week, the KBOO Evening News crew is being sequestered in a secure bunker for their own safety alongside Vice President Dick Cheney. So this week, we offer free speech radio news, independent native news, and featured interviews by our friend Matthew Rothschild, the publisher of the Progressive magazine. We'll be coming back with our usual full mental jacket starting next Tuesday. Don't forget, Monday is Memorial Day. Thank you for your patience. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 24, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll take a look at the government's plans for a worker database in the immigration bill. Community organizations say they intend to sue the Department of Energy for violations at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. And South Central farmers call a red alert after a court orders their eviction. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The Senate Intelligence Committee has endorsed General Michael Hayden to become the new director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The three Democrats who voted against him cited concerns over the warrantless wiretapping domestic surveillance program that began during Hayden's leadership of the National Security Agency. The full Senate is expected to meet for his confirmation hearing tomorrow. Meanwhile, the American Civil Liberties Union announced today that chapters in 20 states are filing complaints with state regulators regarding recent reports of NSA access to the phone records of millions of Americans. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
The ACLU says they are reacting to the two major news stories that have been published in the past 5 months about domestic surveillance. Howard Simon is executive director with the Florida ACLU. He said his group has filed a complaint and request for information for several telephone companies with the Florida Public Service Commission. Simon says that on the face of it, the telephone companies named in the USA Today report have broken Florida law, as he mentioned a specific state statute,
which essentially makes it a misdemeanor with a $25,000 a day violation for the divulgence of customer records unless authorized by customers or required by some legal process.
In Massachusetts, four different mayors are mentioned in complaints sent to the state agency regarding telecommunications. Michael Bissonette is mayor of Chicopee, Massachusetts.
Unfortunately, we've gone from can you hear me now to who can hear me now.
On Tuesday, the Federal Communications Commission declined to investigate whether the NSA had access to millions of Americans' telephone records, citing the secrecy of the National Security Agency. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
A New York jury is deliberating the outcome of a trial of a Pakistani immigrant accused of plotting to blow up Herald Square. Rebecca Miles reports from New York City.
Closing arguments have concluded in the trial of 23-year-old Shauharwar Martin Siraj. The Pakistani immigrant is charged with conspiracy to bomb Herald Square subway, a dense shopping district in Manhattan. Siraj was arrested on the eve of the Republican National Convention in 2004. The defense has argued an undercover informant paid by the NYPD used techniques of entrapment to involve Siraj in a conspiracy. The jury learned that the Egyptian-born police informant made friends with the accused and secretly recorded more than 30 hours of conversations. The defense attorney has argued the U.S. government manufactured the crime, explaining the informant ingratiated himself with the young man and inflamed his political passions with pictures from Abu Ghraib and talk of abuse of Muslims in America and in the Middle East. The prosecution has argued that while everyone is entitled to their political opinions, talk of placing a bomb in a crowded subway system does not qualify as protected free speech. If convicted of conspiracy, Siraj could face 20 years in prison. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting from New York.
In Chile, four Mapuche Indians sentenced to 10 years in prison and ordered to pay nearly $900,000 for an arson campaign are on hunger strike once again. This comes shortly after ending a hunger strike of more than 60 days. In Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón has the story.
Senators who broker a legislative agreement with the government that would allow the four Mapuches to serve their sentences at a halfway house say the new hunger strike endangers the legislation that would benefit them. This weekend, the Mapuches took up their hunger strike for the second time after a parliamentary commission studying the bill recessed for 30 days. The previous hunger strike ended when Congress agreed to consider emergency legislation that would allow the Mapuches to serve their sentences at a halfway house. The Mapuches say they're innocent. They were tried under a Pinochet-era anti-terrorism act for the forest fires set in lands historically controlled by the Mapuches. But today, the government says the emergency legislation period expired as Congress is on recess until June 6. It is not clear what will happen to the hunger strike and the emergency legislation. A Catholic bishop who helped broker the deal walked away from the agreement today. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh chaired a roundtable conference on Kashmir in Srinagar today. The first roundtable conference was held in New Delhi in February of this year. Shanawas Khan reports.
Like the first roundtable conference, Kashmiri separatist groups stayed away from the conference, calling it futile. The moderate faction of the separatist alliance Huriyat Conference had reservations about some people invited to the roundtable talks by Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. Of the 41 invitees, only 30 attended. A general strike called by the hardline faction of Huriyat Conference paralyzed normal life in Kashmir today. Guerrillas struck at four places in Srinagar in spite of heavy security arrangements. Although the roundtable conference was the first of its kind in which an Indian Prime Minister visited Kashmir to discuss Kashmir issue itself, the non-participation of separatist leaders diminished its importance. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shanwas Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
And in Fort Benning, Georgia, the nation's first female conscientious objector has been sentenced to 120 days of confinement for refusing deployment to Afghanistan. Army National Guard Specialist Catherine Jashinsky applied for a discharge 18 months ago, but was denied and later court-martialed for refusing to train with weapons. Jashinsky says that at the end of her sentence, she will resume her studies at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News. The Senate is poised to vote on their entire immigration bill tomorrow, a worker verification program to verify that workers are lawfully working in the United States will be included in the bill. The program would create a database of all new employees hired, which concerns privacy rights groups who say this is just one more government database that could be abused. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
A main reason immigrants come to the United States is to work. To deter employers who hire undocumented immigrants, the Senate established a national system to verify all workers, not just immigrants. Employers will have to add the name, date of birth, social security number, or immigrant number, and state or country of origin into a national database. The database is supposed to confirm if the person is a lawful resident and they are who they say they are. An employer who is caught hiring three or more undocumented immigrants can be fined up to $20,000 per person. If an employee is deemed fraudulent, they have 9 days to appeal. If they win, they will receive back pay if the court agrees. The Senate authorized $400 million to implement this program. Proponents hope this will expunge the use of fraudulent documents and Social Security numbers. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California.
False identity documents are really a no-no in our society. It's a way a society can protect itself. It's a way people are known for who they are, not somebody else.
But rights groups have privacy concerns. Although a last-minute safeguard was added that prohibits the use of the database for any reasons other than the law allows, Gregory Nosheim with the American Civil Liberties Union says the opportunity for identity theft increases with just another database that contains personal information.
Once that system is created, that there will inevitably be mission creep, and that more and more uses for that information will be found to the detriment of the privacy of every working person in the country.
This is not the last word, and yes, there'll be additional privacy issues for us to look at.
That was Democratic Senator from Oregon, Ron Wyden. He said he needed to review them before he spoke about other privacy issues. Further technology is being proposed to simplify the worker verification system. The Verichip Corporation says they have technology that could stop fraudulent activity. It's an implanted radio frequency ID. John Proctor is a spokesperson for Verichip.
Human implantable RFID chip. It's about the size of a grain of rice. The device uses passive RFID technology to communicate a unique 16-digit identification number. That number is then linked to a secure database.
Currently, the chip is used in several hospitals to access a patient's medical records on a computer database. But privacy rights groups say the radio frequency that transmits the information is too easily accessible. Again, Gregory Nosheim with the ACLU.
RFID chips create enormous security problems and privacy problems because under many of the proposals, it's difficult or impossible for the person who possesses a document with the chip to ensure that it isn't constantly broadcasting personal information about them.
John Proctor says the Verichip can't be read more than 6 inches away. Technology will be relied upon heavily to implement many provisions of the immigration bill if it is to pass. A final vote will take place in the Senate tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Iraqi Oil Ministry's Inspector General reports this week that $1 billion of Iraq's oil is being illegally smuggled out of the country every month. Smuggling on such a large scale, coupled with increasing violence and the lack of basic services like water and electricity, have caused increasing tensions in the southern oil city of Basra. Over 100 civilians have been killed in Basra so far this month. Residents there are pointing the finger at the governor and the British military, which occupies the city. FSRN's Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib have more.
Before the recent spate of killings, Basra had a reputation as one of the most peaceful cities in occupied Iraq. The British military, whose 8,000 soldiers control Basra, were considered by many to be more humane than their American counterparts. But when thousands of residents took to the streets earlier this month to protest high unemployment and corruption in the governor's office, the British attacked the demonstration with helicopters. Fighters responded. Asad Karim is president of the Iraqi Oil Workers Union in Basra.
They shot down the helicopter. It was real resistance. They shot it down because the British were supporting the governor and shooting at the people at the demonstration. And the governor didn't stop the British from bombing the demonstration, and so that's his responsibility also.
Amjad Ali al-Jawahari is North American representative of the Iraqi trade union movement. He told FSRN frustration had been building in Basra before the violence broke out.
I visited Basra last year, and I've seen that the piles or mountains of garbage in the city, sewage system is destroyed, water system is not adequate, even clean water is not there, electricity is not up to the expectation. It was at that time, it was you were getting 3 hours a day. Today you're getting 30 minutes or an hour a day, which is way worse than before.
Oil Workers Union President Asad Karim adds the lack of water and electricity aren't the only reasons for rising tensions.
The government in Baghdad was giving a lot of support and money to Basra, but the governor was misusing it, and that led to a lot of violence and a lot of strikes, including walkouts by the military and police. The governor didn't improve security. The security in Basra is so bad. The unemployment is high, and there is corruption in his administration. He's not obeying the laws of the central government.
So far, at least 7 British soldiers and 100 Iraqi civilians are dead in the fighting. Fadl Ashara, the spokesman for the Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr, says British forces and the governor want to blame the killings on sectarian conflict, but he says that's not so.
What happened in Basra is that Ayatollah al-Sistani's representative talked about the corruption created by the governor and his administration, which caused the governor to say that the religious offices were responsible for all the violence in Basra, and that we are dividing people against themselves. I think that as the Sadr movement, this kind of language is not responsible. They should be more responsible in their proclamations. Now, the problem has been solved by the Sadr office. We sent our representative to Basra, and we held a meeting of the two groups to try to solve the problem peacefully.
But clashes with the governor's office are not the only cause of violence in Basra. The National Association of Sunni Clergymen, the Association of Muslim Scholars, complained this week that 1,200 Sunni Arab families from the oil city have been forced out. Iraq's North American Trade Union representative, Amjad Ali al-Jawahari.
They are getting killed and they are getting abducted every day, on a daily basis. So many people are getting, abducted from that area. Just recently, 18 people were abducted and they found them dead somewhere else. Head of one of the tribes was killed and the people from Al-Zubayr attacked the police station. They killed 6 or 7 policemen from the city. The governing council, who are predominantly Shia, try to get rid of the Sunnis from there, and the Sunnis want to, strike back.
Amidst all of this, the Prime Minister of Denmark, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, paid a visit to Basra today. Denmark has 535 troops stationed in Basra. As part of his visit, the Danish Premier announced he'll be bringing some of those troops home starting in July. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
As the U.S. Senate is scheduled to vote next month on a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage, a group of clergy representing various religious traditions are calling on senators to say no to the marriage ban. They believe such an amendment would endanger religious liberty and compromise civil rights. Yan Mei Shea has the story from Washington, D.C.
Representatives of Clergy for Fairness is a coalition of different religious voices. It organized more than 1,600 faith community representatives to sign a petition against the amendment banning gay marriage. As part of their petition drive, several dozen clergy members are on Capitol Hill this week, asking senators to vote against the proposal. Dr. Paul Simmons is an ordained Baptist minister in Louisville, Kentucky. He says such a constitutional amendment smacks of Puritanism and threatens the fundamental value of the separation of church and state.
Puritanism seems never to die. It lives always to try to deprive others of the spirit of freedom and of their own free exercise of rights before and with God. They use religious liberty as a way to camouflage bigotry in the name of God.
The Senate Judiciary Committee passed the federal marriage amendment last week by a vote divided along party lines. Committee Chairman, Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter, said he was against the marriage amendment, but believed it deserves a full Senate debate. Bishop Joe Doss says the definition of marriage goes into the heart of theology and should be actively debated, just not in the Senate.
The place that you debate these kinds of theological issues is in the councils of the church, supported by the seminaries and places of learning, and our churches, synagogues, and houses of worship.
Dr. Kenneth Samuel is an African-American Baptist minister from Atlanta. He reminded people that it was not until 1948 that California struck down the law banning interracial marriage. And now, he says, same-sex couples are in a similar battle for their civil rights.
To discriminate against a class of people is wrong, because a threat to justice anywhere is still a threat to justice everywhere.
Maggie Gallagher, president of the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy, however, opposes categorizing same-sex marriage as a civil rights struggle.
Once a court goes to rule gay marriage is a civil right, that people who have an older conjugal vision of marriage as inherently the union of husband and wife are going to be treated like racists in the public square.
Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist has scheduled a vote on the proposed amendment the week of June the 5th. Most believe it stands little chance of passing. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
According to a coalition of community organizations in northern New Mexico, the Los Alamos National Laboratory is violating regulations of the Clean Water Act. The group intends to sue the Department of Energy and Regents of the University of California, who managed the lab. They are demanding that the lab honor its agreement to clean up the pollution and stop creating more contaminants that are making their way to the Rio Grande. Leslie Clark has more.
The group chose a site next to the Rio Grande to announce their intent to sue the DOE and the University of California. Kathy Sanchez of Tewa Women United is a member of San Ildefonso Pueblo. She says the people of her pueblo, which is adjacent to Los Alamos National Lab, are suffering from 60 years of contamination coming from the lab.
We cannot fish. There's been a protection order or a limit on the amount of fish that you can eat. Our animals that we harvest up there that are sacred to us have a lot of lesions or have a lot of illnesses.
The coalition contends the contaminants from more than 1,400 documented sites at the lab are threatening public health. Many people at San Ildefonso Pueblo, according to Sanchez, are ill from exposure to the toxins dumped at the lab and contaminants released during the Cerro Grande fire in 2000.
So we have a lot of the cancers, the illnesses, and there's a lot of asthma, and there's that fire that happened up there, and we've been inhaling the contaminants that have been airborne, but we're also talking about the water and the water that we drink.
The coalition referred to studies by Los Alamos National Lab and the New Mexico Environment Department showing millions of gallons of liquid radioactive waste and hundreds of thousands of tons of radioactive materials dumped by the lab from as far back as 1943 are migrating towards the river. The group's attorney, Matthew Bishop, warns the future drinking water supply for Santa Fe and Albuquerque are also at risk.
We're seeing high levels of contaminants, primarily PCBs, chromium, and high explosives that are emerging in the surface waters and along the soils of the various canyons. And as you can see from the map here, all of these canyons flow into the Rio Grande, which is really the lifeblood of the state of New Mexico, an extremely important river and water body, not only for the local farmers and fishermen, but also for the urban areas.
The DOE's proposed budget for 2007 indicates a $90 million shortfall for cleanup of the contaminated sites. The coalition suggests using money from potential fines levied on the lab because of its failure to comply with the Clean Water Act, according to Joni Ahrens of Concerned Citizens for Nuclear Safety.
Our preliminary estimates are that there are billions of dollars in fines, potential fines, as a result of not reporting, not monitoring, and then the unauthorized discharges as well over these sites towards the river.
The coalition wants the lab to implement best practices for discharges and dumping, and the group hopes a lawsuit will compel Los Alamos National Lab to clean up legacy waste and stop creating more so the Rio Grande can continue to support the ecosystem along its path. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
The South Central farmers have called a red alert and are asking supporters to take a principled stance to help the nation's largest urban farm. The farmers and their supporters have established an encampment on the 14-acre green space to resist a sheriff's eviction ordered by the court. The farmers were unable to secure the over $16 million demanded by developer Ralph Horowitz to save the farm. Joan Baez, Daryl Hannah, and Julia Butterfly Hill have joined in the call to pressure L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa to intervene on behalf of the South Central Farm, which feeds roughly 350 families. Christina Onestad reports.
Unable to raise the $10 million more dollars needed to buy the South Central Farm, farmers and community activists are camping out and refusing to leave. Tezo Zomok is the elected leader of the South Central Farmers.
Mayor Villaraigosa states that he supports this issue, but he said that he had given up on raising the remaining $10 million that was necessary to purchase this land. And on that same day, the city council and the mayor, of course, were able to find $800 million to renovate a stadium, but they can't find $10 million. And what we're saying to the mayor is that he can't give up that easy, that we need to work together to reach out to the community. This is the beginning of something larger. We're calling out to all our supporters. We're going to camp here. And we're going to take a principled stand for a livable city.
In the middle of an industrial area, the 14-acre urban farm feeds over 350 families. But owner Ralph Horowitz plans to demolish the farm and build warehouses. Some community activists say the farm will become a Walmart. Lisa Albina has been growing food at the South Central Farm since it began over 13 years ago.
No queremos bodega.
We don't want warehouses. We want to be able to plant cabbage, nopales, all kinds of vegetables. We have to struggle here as much as we can to see if they let us stay, because there are a lot of people that have been here struggling just so that we can save this little space. Community members and activists are calling on the developer to sell the land for the price he bought it for at $5 million from the city instead of the $16.5 million he is asking from the farmers. Among those calling on the city to save the South Central Farm were folk singer and activist Joan Baez, actress Daryl Hannah, and activist Julia Butterfly Hill, who has started a tree sit at the farm. Daryl Hannah and Julia Butterfly Hill.
I'd like to put a call out to that developer to swallow his greed, and also a call out to the mayor to fulfill his promise to come and help save this farm.
This community farm represents a community that's growing. Every day I'm on the phone calling new people, and new people are coming. So I hope those who want this place destroyed are listening. This isn't getting smaller, it's getting bigger.
Farmers and community members refuse to leave the South Central Farm without a struggle. Reporting for FSRN from the South Central Farm, I'm Christina Onnestad.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and McMillan. Special thanks today to KPFK program director Armando Ludinho. You can find archives of our newscast and documentaries online at www.fsrn.org. You can also email us your questions, comments, and story ideas to comments at fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. Today I have a historical figure right here in the studio with me, John Dean of Watergate fame, Nixon's former White House counsel, who warned the president that there was a cancer on the presidency, and who then testified against Nixon in the Watergate hearings. He wrote a book about the Nixon scandal called Blind Ambition. He's written several other books since. John Dean now has a new book out, well, not so new, I guess a 2004 book called Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. And he's testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee in favor of Russ Feingold's censure proposal. John Dean, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt. Nice to be here.
Oh, it's real interesting to meet you and to talk with you here.
Actually, I was accused of being at Senator Feingold's hearing to promote Worse Than Watergate by one of the minority members, which was dead wrong.
A late promotion of that book at that. Tell me what your lasting impressions are of Richard Nixon now.
Well, he's, in a way, he's a comic figure. In other ways, he's a tragic figure. And I have a memory of a very complex man in my locked in my synapses.
How long did you work for him?
1,000 days.
Well, there you go.
1,000 days. And it was a, you know, he would, when you listen to the tapes today of Nixon, you realize he had a different personality with different people. He would be one person with his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman. He'd be somebody else with Henry Kissinger. He'd be somebody else with me. And it's really quite interesting that he put these different, he had these different persona. He was always easy to work with for me. No problem.
Did that suggest to you that he didn't know exactly who he was?
That's a real possibility. I don't think he ever had great administrative skills for the presidency. That's why he had someone like Bob Haldeman as chief of staff. And he was slow to interact with his staff. I was there a long time before I started having regular dealings with him. And it was very stiff. It was almost kind of like walking on a set of an Oval Office, if you will, when I used to first go in. But by the time our relationship moves along, I'd walk in and find him with his feet on the desk, and he'd be talking to me around his shoes. So, as I say, he was uneasy. In fact, one of the interesting things about Nixon, we had to prepare something called talking papers. Anytime we brought someone in the office to meet the president. And because this man had zero gift for gab, you literally had to put it, you put the purpose of the meeting, who the person was, and why the meeting was occurring, and so on and so forth. But at the bottom of the memo, you had to have a few sentences to sort of like buzzwords and or thoughts that he could start a conversation with this person, because he wasn't very good at this sort of small talk. So, and if it wasn't there, there were Alex Butterfield, who ushered more people into the office than anyone else, told me, he said, occasionally when he was confronted with somebody where he didn't have this, he was literally speechless.
So, and Butterfield was the guy who surfaced the tapes.
He's the one who indeed corroborated the fact that there were tapes. I had speculated in my testimony that I thought I was taped, and it's the only speculation I put in that Senate testimony back in 1973, and thank God I did, because when they were trying to discredit my testimony, they said, well, you know, they actually had a system where they fanned out and interviewed, you know, all kinds of people, and they were doing it by the minority staff to try to discredit the witnesses. They didn't want to, you know, have their testimony stand up. And so they called Butterfield in, and they said, you know, Dean made this amazing statement that he believed he was recorded. Now, isn't that impossible? And Butterfield said, no, I think he's probably right. He doesn't know it, but Butterfield knew how few people knew about the taping system. But I think he was right. And what had made me aware of the fact I was being taped was Nixon's behavior late in the game, when he literally goes to the corner of his hideaway office and starts whispering around the potted palm in the office and saying, I was foolish to do this, or I made a mistake when I did that. And I said, this man, John, is recording you. He just wasn't very good at that sort of thing.
He was talking to the tape.
Yes.
Did you ever speak with Nixon after he resigned?
Never did. I think it would have been very difficult for him. I'm not the only one who never spoke to him. I know John Ehrlichman never talked to him. John Ehrlichman was his chief domestic advisor. Bob Haldeman and he had sort of parted the way. They did patch up before both men passed away. But that Nixon would have had great difficulty dealing with me at that point, because it was surprising. He said he was very flattering in one sense in his memoirs about me. When he started dealing with me, he said, well, you know, he'd written in his diary, you know, this got this bright young guy and so on and so forth, some nice stuff. But then he says I was obviously a traitor for breaking rank and trying to blow everything up. Trying to save him.
Yeah, how have you dealt with that accusation?
It doesn't bother me at all, because everybody for whom I had any respect, I told what I was going to do before I did it. And I said, listen, I'm not going to lie for anybody. And it's just not that way. So plan your life around that. And then when I said I was going to go to the prosecutors, after I'd tried to tell the president that he was in deep trouble, as you alluded to, the so-called cancer on the presidency conversation, after that, you know, people knew where I stood, and I actually had the support of some of my colleagues who said, do it. And, you know, in one sense, what my plan was, and one of the reasons I broke rank, is I thought that my colleagues would do the right thing, that they would stand up and tell the truth, and it would end it. And Nixon himself might save himself by coming forward and saying, yeah, I made some bad mistakes, and here's what I did. What I did is just escalated the cover-up to the point where he had no option other than to finally resign or be impeached.
Yeah, I mean, some people think he could have saved his presidency by, even at those 11th hour, 11th and a half hours, by coming forward, apologizing, and getting everything out.
Well, Americans like to give their president, if not their representative or senator, the benefit of the doubt. And if you look at the poll numbers, people knew Nixon was deeply involved in Watergate and stayed with him, even those who might not have voted for him for a long time. So it's a natural tendency.
Did you ever speak with Haldeman or Ehrlichman afterwards, and what was that like?
Both of them I ran into. Haldeman I had talked to, because I happened to run into him in the office building he was working in. We talked about getting together for lunch. We're friendly. We never happened, and he died shortly thereafter. Both Haldeman and Ehrlichman died relatively young. They were in their early, late 60s, early 70s when they passed away. Haldeman, for example, he was a Christian Scientist, and he got stomach cancer, and he could have been treated, but decided because of his religious beliefs he was not going to even take treatment, and sort of he went that way, which was rather, notwithstanding his family trying to get him to take some health treatments and deal with it, he didn't want to.
And Ehrlichman came around partly to understanding that Nixon had done something terribly wrong, didn't he?
He did. He pointed the finger at Nixon, and it actually, his defense for a lot of his actions was sort of a Nuremberg defense, where he said, well, I was just following orders. And so he had no doubt in his mind, nor did Haldeman. Both of them actually realized that they had broken the law by the time it was all over.
Mm-hmm. Speaking with John Dean, I'm very interested in the comparisons you draw between Nixon and Bush. Could you lay out some of those? Because they don't seem obvious at the top, because Nixon so bad in social relations and social graces and inability to make small talk, whereas, you know, that's Bush's calling card.
Well, as I write a regular column, when I promised myself when I turned 60, which I did several years ago now, that I would return to writing, which I enjoy. I'd had a successful career in business, so I could do it, and I have done it. And I do a biweekly column for an organization called Fine Law, which is run by a large legal publishing operation. And I started writing, when Bush came into office, I started writing columns about the Bush presidency. I'd been writing the column several years before that, but I was stunned at the secrecy of the administration, and I was also surprised that no one in the major media was writing about it. And I knew that there's just no good that comes out of secrecy. So I began looking closely at Bush and finding these striking Nixonian features of this presidency. It's almost as if we'd left an old playbook in the basement. They found it, dusted it off, and said, this stuff looks pretty good. We ought to give it a try. As I dug in and still had some pretty good sources within that presidency, I found that really the principal mover and shaker of this presidency is clearly Dick Cheney. But let me focus on your question of the similarities between Bush and Nixon, which are not readily apparent. I've discovered that both men, when you look at them, learned about the presidency from men they greatly respect. Richard Nixon from Dwight Eisenhower, George Bush from his father, Bush one. When both men became president, you get the very distinct impression that they don't feel that they quite fit in the shoes of the person about whom they learned the presidency. And Nixon, for example, would constantly be going down to Key Biscayne, San Clemente. He'd be out on the road. And just was very uneasy, or up at Camp David. He just didn't like being in the Oval Office. And I saw this same pattern in George Bush, who is constantly away from the Oval Office itself. The other striking similarity is both men talk in the third person about the office of the president, as if it's just unusual. It's like the royal we, if you will. You look at other presidents like, say, Reagan or Clinton, who clearly filled that office. In fact, you almost had to pry Clinton out of the office when his term was over. And Reagan, despite whatever weaknesses he had intellectually, certainly, you know, filled the role of president and was playing the role to the hilt and enjoying it. So this was a very Nixonian sort of a distance from the office. The other thing is, of course, the way they've set up the White House, the structures, the secrecy, and, of course, not merely reviving the imperial presidency, but expanding it beyond Nixon's wildest dream.
I'm speaking with John Dean. You're listening to the Progressive Radio Show. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of that magazine. You know, Nixon had a kind of insane paranoid streak to him, and was threatening to firebomb the Brookings Institution, or late at night, I think he speculated about bombing Capitol Hill even. I mean, we don't get that sense of paranoia from Bush, or do you?
Well, the reason I wrote a book with the title Worse Than Watergate, and was very cautious in using that title, given my knowledge of Watergate, was that there's a real difference when you look at what's happening today and what happened during Watergate. Nobody died as a result of the so-called abuses of power during Nixon's presidency. You might make the exception of, say, the secret bombing of Cambodia, but that never really got into the Watergate litany per se. I'm talking about that really falls in that sort of historical chapter where they list, you know, what the abuses were. You look at Bush's abuses and Cheney's. To me, it's a Bush/Cheney presidency. And today, people are dying as a result of abuse of power. That's much more serious.
Dying in Iraq.
God knows where they're dying, in secret prisons. To me, the fact that a vice president could go to Capitol Hill and lobby for torture is just unbelievable. Just unbelievable. The fact that a small clique of attorneys in the Department of Justice could write, how do we get around the Geneva Convention so we can torture during interrogations, is just, I can't even get there mentally. And when you read their briefs, they didn't get there mentally either.
It is shocking what these guys have gotten away with. Talk a little bit more about Cheney, because the subtitle of this book is The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush, but I think the actual one would be The Secret Presidency of Dick Cheney. You call him co-president in this book.
I really do, and they really are. I had, as I say, some very, very good sources within this White House, and they... I did this book at a time, I actually wrote it in 2003, before anyone was paying any attention to any of these issues that have now surfaced in the major media.
I mean, the amazing thing is it came out before the NSA scandal appeared, or the Valerie Plame scandal blew up.
Absolutely. They just keep walking into my title and adding what could be for even additional chapters. But in other words, the base material is what I covered, and sort of the mentality. But what happened is, and it was evident really at the time of the transition in 2000 after the election, when Cheney is very confident that they're going to win at the Supreme Court, and they're deep into planning the White House and how it's going to be structured. I've got some friends who are in there, and they're telling me what's happening, and they say, you know, Bush doesn't have a clue what's going on. Cheney's setting this thing up the way he wants it. He's designing a National Security Council that'll probably be more powerful than the statutory National Security Council under Condoleezza Rice, and it was, and it is. I mean, she was the perfect foil for him, because he can roll over her anytime he wants to, and does. And even putting her over to states even better. Even less problems having to keep her out on the road. So it's the Cheney Rumsfeld connection has really just been driving the foreign policy from day one.
Why do you think Bush divested so much of his power to this man?
Bush had expertise in one thing, and that was how to run a presidential campaign. He understands campaign and presidential politics. He has no interest or disposition, or I think probably he's not stupid, but he's not bright. He's not a rocket scientist either. He isn't interested in policy. Cheney is the opposite. He loves this stuff. He's a wonk, and he gets into it, and he's had very strong feelings about issues that he's held for a long time, and he has been determined And in fact, when I testified in front of Senator Feingold's committee, I said, I can't find in history any other presidency that's made it a matter of policy to expand presidential powers. What we've done in the past is they've been expanded because of an issue or a reason to expand them. This presidency, it's the reason alone.
And Cheney has bragged to Bob Woodward about that.
Absolutely.
That's been his goal, to restore it to its status prior to Watergate, or
absolutely,
prior to Iran-Contra and all of that. Tell me about the Feingold hearing. First of all, your response to Feingold's suggestion, proposal on censure.
Well, I've been invited several times over the last decade or more to testify before Congress, and I've always politely found a way not to do it.
Why is that, John Dean?
I knew it was going to make a certain sensation my first return to, after giving my Senate testimony during Watergate, that it would be a little bit of a media event for my appearing there. So I thought it should be an issue that was important. It should be an issue that I felt strongly about. And when Senator Feingold invited me to appear on his censure resolution, I thought this is a very good issue, because I think that and I appeared not as a partisan. I think my partisan days are really long behind me.
How do you identify yourself politically right now?
I registered as an independent, and I vote for as many Democrats as I do Republicans. I really look at the person and how they, or the issue and what's involved, and try to come out with I really am a centrist in many ways, and don't, you know, I don't fly on either wing, if you will. But anyway, so I didn't go as a partisan and made that very clear, but I thought the issue was important. I explained how a lot of baggage is connected with censure, but how important it was that the Senate do something, because he's addressing really a blatant violation of law, the violation of the Foreign Intelligence Security Act, FISA. And the president, you know, when Lincoln, for example, suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War, he went to Congress to seek permission after the fact. You know, all the things that Lincoln did when he pushed the envelope, he got permission after the fact. We have a president who says, screw that, I'm just going to do it. And it's sort of an in-your-face attitude. And he's rolling over the prerogatives of the Congress. I noticed that Senator Specter, the chairman of the committee, has now said, well, I want to get I'm going to do something about this more than the censure, in a sense. He's now talking about withdrawing funding for NSA unless they report to the Senate what they're doing.
I mean, it is amazing, the violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that Bush has been committing, and he's acknowledged that he's just not going to go that route. You made a famous comment, I think it should be famous anyway, when he said that. You said this is the first time that a president has actually confessed to an impeachable offense.
It's exactly what he did. Richard Nixon was one of the provisions in his bill of impeachment, in the article of impeachment, was his warrantless surveillance of NSA and media people, which is now covered directly by the FISA law. And so the House made it very clear that warrantless wiretapping is an impeachable offense. And so, I mean, it couldn't be any clearer.
The other thing you call a possible impeachable offense in your book is the possibility, to my mind, the likelihood that Bush lied this country into war, into the Iraq war, made so many misleading and deceitful comments that he should be impeached for that. Is that still your position?
I'm convinced, as I deconstructed his statements, particularly his State of the Union, just before the Iraq War.
This is in January 2003, then.
Right. And when I took the key core of that speech and looked at even the available information then, that if he had anyone had done any sort of research at all, that it was clear that the representations he was making to the Congress as fact were not fact. Now, is that lying? It certainly is a form of distortion. And this is the highest point in a presidency in his relationship with the Congress, is when he reports the State of the Union. And this is a crime to lie to Congress. The way he did it in the follow-up procedures, he actually belittled the Congress in many ways and sent him bogus material. It was really quite stunning when one peels it all apart. And I said, is there any question in my mind this is an impeachable offense? No, because back in the Nixon proceeding, the secret Cambodia bombing became an issue, and that probably would have been considered an impeachable offense, but for the fact it turned out not to be secret. Nixon had briefed all of the key ranking and chairmen of the relative committees that had jurisdiction over all those issues. They'd been told in advance what he was doing in Cambodia. So you can't say the Congress didn't know that he was bombing in Cambodia.
No, I think members of the House Judiciary Committee back then were considering or drafting articles along those lines and decided not to make them one of the three articles.
They also did legal research and determined that there was no question that based on a lot of the state conventions and the founders' words, that misrepresentation to the Congress, the House or Senate, was to be an impeachable offense.
I'm speaking with John Dean. You're listening to Progressive Radio. When I go around and talk about impeachment, people usually respond by saying it's impossible, it's politically impossible. The New York Times editorialized on censure against that and against impeachment, calling impeachment a fairy tale. I saw a poll that said 33% of Americans are in favor of impeachment. Is that a high number or a low number where we are versus where things were with Nixon? And how do you respond to people who just say it's never going to happen?
Well, I think there's a political reality about impeachment that clearly it is a very political process. It is purely a political process. Yes, there are some definitions of high crimes and misdemeanors and treason and bribery that are in the Constitution, but the interpretation of that language is purely political. It can reach a line about sex in the Oval Office. It can reach a long way, that clause.
Yeah, we saw that.
We saw that. We know that. Which was an absurd use of the impeachment clause. It is the big canon, and as long as the same party that controls the Congress is in the White House, it just isn't going to happen. Unless, I'm not even sure if a president murdered his wife, they would impeach him. It's too political. But I think that those who are focusing on this issue are raising important questions. And one of the reasons I thought it was important that a censure resolution was appropriate was I thought back, if somebody had censured Nixon or even a resolution of either House or Senate to say, listen, what you're doing is unacceptable to the Congress, that shot across the bow might have straightened him up. And I wish it still can, Feingold's censure resolution get more traction, it might provide us all some safety, because there's two more years left of this presidency. But one more thing. Mm-hmm. If there's a good possibility in November, the House or Senate are going to go to the Democrats. And it's going to be hell for this presidency for the last 2 years, and they've earned it. And that's when impeachment could become a true reality. I'd settle for oversight, but impeachment's not out of the question.
That's why I think if things get hotter, and if Democrats get control of the House, for instance, that censure may become attractive to Bush, if he's got any sense, because it would be a way for him to, put a lid on this cauldron.
It's not a bad idea, because they have supplied a steady diet of material. And as I say, I think it'll be 2 years of executive privilege fights, and the subpoena will change the complexion of the oversight.
John Dean, your testimony, which I read before the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Feingold censure hearing, you testified that this is the first time that you actually have feared our government. That struck me. Why is that?
Now, I don't frighten easily. I understand the government. I find it frightening because I think that Dick Cheney knows no limits. He's got a the only person Cheney reports to is George Bush. He works behind closed doors. He is a, you know, I just know from little tidbits I'm picking up from friends who have to be careful not to speak out of school that there's probably more covert activity both abroad and even maybe here in the United States than there has been in decades going on because of this so-called war on terror.
Do you fear for our democratic system?
I fear for the system. I fear for the system. And I fear that for our liberties, because only a small group of people fight for our liberties. And once we start on the slippery slope and those people are put in jeopardy, then we're really in trouble.
I think we're going to have to end it there. John Dean, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Independent Native News for Wednesday, the 24th of May. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Tension at a construction site in southern Ontario has died down, and a barricade erected by members of the Six Nations Reserve has also come down. Violence broke out on Monday when the First Nation then tried to remove the barricade, which was erected in April after police stormed the peaceful protest at the housing project in Caledonia. On Monday, a transformer was also vandalized, which cut off power to the town of Caledonia and outlying communities. Power was still out as of Tuesday evening. But the violence had subsided, according to CKRZ reporter Mark Bearcliff, who was on a cell phone at the site. He says the ongoing negotiations between tribal members and the federal government prompted Tuesday's removal of the barricade.
The two traditional chiefs that are kind of the main people in the talks for Six Nations today, and they said that, you know, the government kept bringing up, you know, about the road blockade. So they said, you know, take their blockade down and let's get to the real issue.
That issue relates to the Six Nations' claim that the land in question was taken from them by the government in the 1840s. The Six Nations says it never willingly gave up the land, nor was it compensated for it. This week's tension mounted as negotiations with the government and the First Nation were finally moving forward. Bearcliff says the violence that erupted Monday was surprising, considering the Six Nations members were removing the barricade in a goodwill effort when non-Aboriginal protesters set up their own blockade. Bearcliff says many members of the Six Nations Reserve are frustrated with the mainstream media's coverage of the event, which they say is not balanced.
One news agency, CH in particular, that people aren't happy with, there was an incident about a week and a half ago where on Highway 6 there was like rocks being thrown between the two sides, and it only showed the Native people throwing stuff back, and it blurred out the non-Native people's faces but showed the Native people's faces.
Bearcliff says as many as 3,000 Six Nations members were at the blockade on Monday, standing ground against the non-Aboriginal protesters. At one point, there was talk of the army being called in to control the situation. As of Tuesday, the violence had subsided and talks centered around furthering negotiations with the government. In other news, the Acoma Tribe of New Mexico is poised to celebrate the grand opening of a cultural center and museum. As KSUT's Jones Whistler reports, tribal leaders say the facilities have been long awaited.
Tribal leaders say the Sky City Cultural Center and Haaku Museum, located about 45 miles west of Albuquerque, New Mexico, were developed as an expression and instructional portal to the Sky City Pueblo. The Pueblo is the oldest continuously inhabited city in North America and overlooks the new building from atop a sheer-walled 370-foot sandstone mesa. That bluff has been home to the Acoma people for 2,000 years. The new 40,000-square-foot building housing the Cultural Center and Museum cost more than $15 million to complete. It boasts materials, architecture, and site planning that tribal officials say was conscientiously chosen to evoke Acoma ancestry at Mesa Verde and Chaco Canyon. The tribe's repatriation plan, currently underway, aims to bring an estimated 50,000 Acoma art pieces and other objects back to their homeland from areas around the country. In Southwest Colorado, I'm Joan Zwissler.
Republican leaders in the U.S. House hope to get a bill to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling passed before their Memorial Day break. Brian Kennedy, a spokesman for House Resources Committee Chairman Richard Pombo, says the bill does not hold any big surprises.
This is the very same ANWR language that has passed the House five times since 2001 and has been passed by a majority in the Senate at least one or two times since 2001. So absolutely nothing different.
PacWest, the political consulting firm hired by the Alaska State Legislature to promote ANWR drilling, released a poll yesterday that claims a majority of Americans now favor it. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie C. Hitchcock.